Hey, folks, welcome to this week's podcast. It's a long one. Let me explain. We first speak to Steve Boone, the author of Hotter Than a Matchhead, My Life on the Run with a Lovin' Spoonful. It's about a 45-minute conversation, and I just had a hard time getting short answers, but there were a lot of interesting stuff. But what it means is that we didn't get to some of the most interesting part of the book. After 1970, after the Lovin' Spoonful is over, Steve gets in trouble, takes a lot of drugs, becomes a convicted drug smuggler. A lot of crazy stuff happens. Married four times. We don't get to any of that. What we do talk about mostly is his career with the Lovin' Spoonful, which is shorter than I think most people think it was. The band didn't last long. They walked an amazing line of sort of making great pop records. Songs like Summer in the City are such little pieces of pop perfection, AM radio, you know, number one hits. Yet they still sort of had some credibility and a foot in the hippie world, in the folk world. They melded it all together and had a lot of hits in a very short time. And of course, didn't get paid any money at all until the 90s. We're going to hear from Steve Boone, and if you want to hear the rest of the story about the drug smuggling, etc., buy a copy of his book. After Steve, we're going to hear from Scottish musician Francis McDonald. He's a friend of mine. He's just a super musical guy, and he collaborated with the late Kim Fowley quite a few times, so I thought it'd be interesting to hear from somebody who'd worked with Kim and hear some stories about how that actually went. And so Francis does a great job, you know, putting us right there working with Kim Fowley. So a little tribute to the late Kim Fowley. But before that, my talk with Steve Boone, which was quite interesting. And like I said, I loved the book. Some interesting things coming up. Check WFMU.org/Michael to check them out. And I will talk to you soon. Here is my chat with Steve Boone.
Unbelievable.
I never, ever, ever get sick of that song. It is a magical song, like I said, under 2 minutes long, and just, it is just something beautiful about it. Steve Boone, welcome to WFMU. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. I am doing very well. Thank you. The weather has just turned warm here, and I'm enjoying it a bunch.
Are you in South Carolina? Is that where you live nowadays?
No, I actually live in Northeast Florida.
Northeast Florida.
I had been in Carolina we went up there to build a recording studio out in the Eastern Pine Barrens, but the economy collapsed right as I was clearing the land, and I just couldn't get financing for it, so we moved back here to Flagler Beach, Florida, which is also a very wonderful place.
You are the author of this new book called Hotter Than a Matchhead, Life on the Run with a Lovin' Spoonful. And the first thing, as I said earlier in the program, and I said it to you in an email, is that I really commend you for just your straight-up honesty. So many of these books are sort of like a press release about a person's life as opposed to a real account, warts and all, about how you felt and everything you did. And we're going to get into some of it, but there's a lot of heavy stuff that goes on in this book. You know, did you say to yourself, if I'm going to do this, I must do it honestly?
Well, you know something, Mike, that's exactly what I said. There had been other attempts at doing the Love and Spoonful story, and over the years, a lot of people had claimed to speak for the band and know what really happened. And so, despite the fact that my life continued on after and before the Love and Spoonful, the Love and Spoonful period was a very uncovered by reality in terms of what was put down on paper for people to know about the band. And yes, I determined that if I'm going to do this project, and my co-writer, Tony Moss, agreed that we had to tell all and as fairly and honestly as possible.
Yeah. You're born in 1943 in North Carolina. Your dad was a military guy. He was also in the hotel business. You moved to the Poconos after the war to manage a hotel, and then in 1954 moved to Florida, where you are now. And it seemed like here you are about 10 years old. You're swimming, you're sailing, you're into, you know, you deliver newspapers. You've kind of got the all-American childhood going on. And I think even at that age, you thought you may be in the military when you grew up. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In fact, when I was 8 years old, before I moved to Florida, I joined the Marine Corps League Junior Rifle Association and would go down every weekend to Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and participate in drills and marksmanship and model building. It was wonderful, and all I ever really thought about during that period was being a Marine Corps aviator, and I hoped and prayed that was going to be the outcome. And as you know, in the book I describe in 1960 a terrible automobile accident which rendered me unfit for military service. And that ended that dream right then and there in 1960.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's talk about music. What was, I mean, in the early 50s, early rock and roll, did it hit you? Did you know at that time there was some connection to you with music? When was the first connection you had?
Well, there was two first connections. The first was that my older brother, Skip, 6 years my senior, had been playing guitar from about age 14 on. And from age 8, I'm looking at him and going, that's an awful cool thing to be doing. And then in 1955, he formed one of the first rock bands in North Florida, the Blue Suedes. And so I always had it as like, gee, that's a really cool thing my brother's doing. But up until 1960, I just thought it was a cool thing and that I would love to be involved with music, but I didn't think of it as a career. Mm. But then, go back a couple of years, the last year I was in Florida, I was crewing with my neighbor who raced little utility boats on the St. John's River. And on the way home back to St. Augustine, Peggy Sue by Buddy Holly came on the radio. And I've got to tell you, I almost fell out of the car. I was so knocked out by hearing that song and getting turned on to Buddy Holly. So really, Skip and his music and hearing Buddy Holly on the radio that day in 1957 just completely floored me. And so when the time came and I was ineligible for military service, I had learned guitar while recuperating from the accident, and then music became a new focus for me. So it was kind of a three-stage event.
Yeah, it's interesting because Peggy Sue sort of, like Do You Believe in Magic, is just one of those magical songs I never get sick of. So 1958, you guys moved, your dad, again for business reason, moves to East Hampton, Long Island, very different from Florida, and you're about 15 years old at this time, and pretty, you're into cars, you're into all this, and eventually you get into this car accident, which, as you said, kind of changes the trajectory of your life. Your brother's in a band called the Kingsmen, who are play clubs and bars around with a guy named King Charles, who's the leader of the band, and slowly you become the rhythm guitar player in that band. Tell me what this guy King Charles was like, and what the typical set was for this band, the Kingsmen, at the time, and what the club scene was like out there.
Well, it was really a great scene. You know, in the Hamptons in the summertime, I call the Hamptons actual greatest period of time was the 1950s and 60s. And so when I had recovered from my accident enough to be active again and had been practicing guitar every day during that recuperation, Skip came to me and said, look, we need a rhythm guitar player in the band. Would you consider joining? And I did. I took him up on the offer, and I was really glad I did. But then we were playing primarily at a club that was near the Air Force Base in West Hampton, New York. And so the crowd was consisted of about half of the Air Force guys that were off duty and blowing off some steam, and the locals that would come. So it was a packed house every night we played there. And King Charles, I can't speak highly enough of him. He was just really one of my real mentors in the music business. And our set list, as it evolved, when I first joined the band, it was just mostly the top 40 hits of the day. But as we went along in the next year's time, King Charles introduced what are called standards, which are songs from the 30s and 40s at that time that were big band songs and orchestra songs. And he gave me some lessons because I didn't take musical education. I only absorbed what I could do by watching my brother and others around me. And he gave me some tips on how to play complicated charts that to this day, I don't think I ever got better lessons from anybody in the music business on than I did from King Charles.
That's very interesting. And eventually you switch to bass. And again, I think in the book you sort of say, he just tells you, just play the scales and, you know, until you figure out a bass line and you'll be fine. You know what key the song is in, and you're sort of off to the races doing it. Well, I want to remind folks we're talking to Steve Boone. His book is called Hotter Than a Matchhead, Life on the Run with a Lovin' Spoonful. You can buy an autograph copy of the book over at steveboone.net and check out information about Love and Spoonful at loveandspoonful.com. Eventually, your brother starts hanging out in Greenwich Village where things, you know, because the King Charles area is kind of the late 50s, early 60s. As the mid-60s come, your brother starts moving down to Greenwich Village, and one day you go down and visit him, and he introduces you to the guys who are going to make up the core of the Love and Spoonful. Life seemed to be changing so fast, kind of with the post-World War II world, you know, just evolving, and from this kind of primer situation out on the island to this more hippie scene in the village. Was it an easy transformation for you to make those two worlds?
Well, actually, you know, Mike, it was because of two things that were going on in my life and in the world around me at the time. In the early 1960s, 60, 61, the Kingston Trio and the early movement of folk music into pop music was beginning. And the Kingston Trio was actually the first album, LP, that I ever bought. And I loved what was on there, but I was into rock music, and I didn't see the two mixing at the time. But by the time that I had begun playing with the Kingsmen, Skip and I, on days that we weren't working in the nightclubs, would start doing hootenannies, where we'd play the songs that we were hearing from the folk music set, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Kingston Trio, Trini Lopez, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie. And then, all of a sudden, this crazy guy with a funny voice started coming out of the radio with the name Bob Dylan. And that really changed for me. That changed the equation right then and there, because all of a sudden, words of a song started to mean much more than they did before that. And I really jumped into it on my own. Of course, people around me were also becoming absorbed with this new folk music, especially epitomized by Mr. Dylan. And as I listened to it more and more, I became much more comfortable with the lifestyle that the hippies, as we weren't quite called at that point, we were still beatniks, but it was appealing to me, and so I really did like it. Meanwhile, I'm still playing in a rock band, and in 1964, I announced to the band that I was going to take 6 months off and go to Europe with my best friend and do a motorcycle tour around Europe. First of all, to track down this Mercy Beat sound that we were starting to hear from across the ocean, and to see if I couldn't hear it firsthand in person. And then also just to do a coming-of-age trip, which is something I always wanted to do my whole life, was to go see Europe. And what better way to do it on a motorcycle? So in September 64, Peter Davey and I bought motorcycles in London, and by December of 1964, it was time to head home, and when I got back, after a fabulous trip. Really, one of the most beautiful things I've ever done was that trip to Europe. But after I got back and went to New York City to pick up my motorcycle, which had been shipped home on a steamship, my brother Skip, who I was staying with while I was there, suggested I go meet these two guys that were looking for a bass player. And, of course, those two guys were John Sebastian and Zal Yanofsky. And as they say in the business, the rest is history.
Yeah. Well, what is amazing, and the book paints this picture, is, you know, you guys basically jam a few times, and your background with the Kingsmen, you know, a lot of blues, and you're comfortable, you know, just joining in and jamming stuff up. And you learn, you know, you guys know a lot of songs in common, and pretty quickly you've got a set together. Pretty quickly you start gigging. People are, you know, there's a little bit of a figuring it out period and how to sort of get the volume right for this kind of folk pop, you know, melding. And then people, Phil Spector wants to sign you, which turns out to be a good move. You turn him down. You start making some demos with Eric Jacobson, and pretty soon you're signed to Karma Sutra, and Do You Want to Believe in Magic is out as a single. I mean, how long from when you met those guys did Do You Believe in Magic come out as a single?
Well, that's, you know, it's a great question, and for one reason, it's a great question for several reasons, but the main reason for me was when I met John and Zali in December, right before Christmas 1964, I had already enrolled in the spring semester at Southampton College, the new school that was just opening up out in Long Island there, and I told them at the time, I said, look it, I have to either pursue my education or I have to pursue something that's going to put money in my pocket. And I said, if this plan that you guys have doesn't mature or at least show signs of happening in 6 months' time, I said, I'll take off the spring semester, but I'm going to go back to school next fall. And you know something, Mike? It was almost 6 months to the day when Do You Believe in Magic was coming out, and we were heading for California on our first tour supporting the release of Do You Believe in Magic. So it really was magical for me.
That is an insane timetable, but everything about what happens to the Love and Spoonful is really compressed. I mean, the amount of work you guys get done and gigs and tours in such a short time is truly astounding. Now, you know, we're talking about 1964, 65, and the Beatles were going crazy, and there was sort of this idea that American groups were going to have a hard time for a while, yet here was the Love and Spoonful, you know, 10 top 40 hits, 7 top 10 hits. Was there, you know, and there's a lot of American music in your music, like you said, the folk, and there's some country, and there's some jug band and some blues behind the Love and Spoonful. Was that a conscious decision to not be the Beatles while other bands were sort of racing to try to fill that gap?
Yeah, well, you know, that's, again, a great point you're making, because we shopped around Do You Believe in Magic to all the major American labels, and they all loved it, every one of them, Joe Smith, Warners, and all the major label heads heard that demo and loved it, but they said, you know something, guys, if you had a British accent, we could give you a record deal, but without a British accent, I don't think you could make it in today's market. Finally, as you pointed out, Kama Sutra did give us a label and a deal on their label. And Kama Sutra was a record label that was started by three young guys but knew how to get songs onto the AM radio. Because remember, in 1964, 65, FM radio was not a major player in the game yet. AM radio was where all of the music was being played at that time in history. So we signed with Kama Sutra. But actually, you know, it was more or less a conscious decision to sound like good time music. John had written a song called Good Time Music, and we kind of had that as our unofficial motto. So when we decided what music we were going to put onto our records and play as part of our show, it wasn't a decision to be different than the Beatles, but it was a decision to have a good time feeling come through on all the music we were playing, whether it was blues-based, jug band-based, country-based, folk-based. And I don't mean to say that it had to all be, you know, happy-go-lucky stuff. There was a lot of serious music made, but we really tried to concentrate with good time music as our motto and our, maybe you might say, our theme of the music the Love and Spoonful made. And the way we went about making our records, really was a lot. As the 60s wore on, several people came to us trying to get us to be involved in the anti-war movement. And whether we had personal political feelings, we didn't want it to enter into our music. So we declined the offers to do that. And whether personally any of us supported or were against the war wasn't part of our decision on that count.
That's interesting. Yeah, I definitely think the good time attitude comes through with the Love and Spoonful. And I want to get back to that about when the band breaks up, because maybe that plays a part in that. So you're the piano player. You do some arranging on these Love and Spoonful record. The first LP is a big hit, and I think it's like you say in the book, there's 10 weeks between LPs. 10 weeks later, they want another LP, which is, again, mind-boggling. You do a little session work on Bob Dylan's Bring It All Back Home. I think John Sebastian goes in to play harmonica, and they're having trouble with the bass sound, and they just ask you to work on that. Things are blowing up. You Didn't Have to Be So Nice is a number 10 hit from your second record, a song that you co-wrote. Daydream is a number 2 hit. Did You Ever Have to Make Up Your Mind is number 2. Jug Band Music is number 2 in Canada. Were you happy with the way the bass sound was sounding on those LPs?
Well, you know, again, well, you seem to have a very good inside knowledge of the Love and Spoonful, because our producer, Eric Jacobson, was brilliant. He still is. He's a brilliant man, a very dear friend of mine, great producer. However, his background was folk music. He was in a band called the Knobloch Upper 10,000, and his mixing skills were, without criticism, as good as it gets. But he didn't hear bass and bass drum in the same way that, say, a rock music producer would. So we would go at it every now and then about the bass and bass drum not being loud enough in our mixes. But, you know, at the end of the day, what counts is how did the records do? And they became hits, and whether I was personally in favor of more bass in the mix or not wasn't the important thing. What was important is that Eric was delivering the goods when it came to making records sound good enough to be on the radio. And remember, in 1965... even in the finest recording studios, the final mixes for singles that were going to be on the air were mixed to little 7-inch car speakers, because that's where most people listened to their music in those days. So the bass and bass drum would not really be a big player on a 7-inch car speaker.
Yeah.
And so I can really understand Eric's point, but yes, I was a little bit disappointed in the amount of bass that was in the final mixes.
But you're right, those records do just come out of those small speakers sounding amazing, as just like, I think having that perspective is very, very wise on your part. So, well, one thing that I have to kind of make sure I re-inject here is the fact that you, at this point, are still 21, 22 years old. You're still kids, and you know, you're being blown up into this world where there's package tours with all these musicians you know, and some of them you love and respect, and John Sebastian, 21 years old, you're doing some songwriting, everyone's contributing a little, but Sebastian is bringing in these amazing songs. I mean, did your guys' mind blow when he would bring these songs in, or was it just that's business as usual?
Well, it became business as usual. John Sebastian will go down in musical history as one of the benchmark songwriters,
yes,
of the 1960s.
Yeah.
He just had a way with a phrase of turning a phrase and putting it into a song that was, I hate to use this expression, it was magical. And we were. At first, you know, do you believe in magic? Well, okay, that's a great hit. Everybody's got one great hit in them, but they just kept coming.
Well, how different were the songs when John brought them in? How much did the band add arrangement-wise and idea-wise? Did they change much?
Well, some of them did, some of them didn't. Do You Believe in Magic? Essentially, John brought in a basic song, and then we were going to use it. We did use the auto harp on that song, and the auto harp brought with it a wonderful, rich array of sounds that had never been heard in a recorded rock song.
Yeah.
But it also brought with it some problems, how to record it, how to get a proper miking on. There was no such a thing as an electronic auto harp, so we had to put a contact mic on it. So that song did evolve in the studio. John brought in the basic arrangement, the intro, verse, chorus, and the middle eight and out. But that song was pretty much arranged beyond the basic arrangement by everybody in the studio. as the songs went on, it would be pretty much the same formula for almost all of them, except songs like, well, for example, What a Day for a Daydream. John pretty much had that whole song in his mind when he brought it into us. And there were a couple others. Mostly the songs that were light instruments and primarily a vocal song. Daydream is one that comes to mind. But in general, I would say the Lovin' Spoonful in the studio, along with Eric Jacobson, put most of those records together as you heard them on the LP and on the singles in the studio, rather than being totally done when John brought them in.
Yeah, one of the amazing things about that makes your band different, than many bands at the time, was that you guys played your own instruments and wrote all your own singles. You did some covers on the albums, but all the singles are songs you wrote, and you play your own instruments, and there's just such a wide range of sound and experimentation. Like you said, the mixing, I agree, that is particularly good on those Lovin' Spoonfuls. You and Joe make it just a classic 60s rhythm section. I think at this time you guys are, like I said, you're going on package tours with like the Turtles, the Bo Brummels, the Yardbirds, Sonny and Cher, Chad and Jeremy, the Beach Boys, the Temptations. I think you say the Temptations are the first people who introduce you to cocaine, which is a beginning of a long road that you go down. You also talk about the Beach Boys. Tell me about playing with the Beach Boys. You talk about Mike Love in the book that I found very interesting.
Well, you know, we all love the Beach Boys, and in fact, we emulated their sounds on a lot of our records. Growing up, or not growing up, but in my period of time I spent out on Long Island, the Beach Boy music wasn't really, really popular. The New York and the East Coast sound, which was doo-wop, and, well, vocally it was similar, but the beat, the Four Seasons, was more the East Coast band, and then the Beach Boys were the West Coast band. But I always liked the Beach Boys. From the very first song of theirs that I heard, all the way through it, I thought they were terrific. You can't beat family harmonies. When you have three brothers singing together, it's going to sound terrific. And the Beach Boys were essentially a family band. Al Jardine was a cousin. Mike Love was a cousin. Or no, Al Jardine was a family friend, but the rest of them were all related by blood. And so we loved them to death, and we always loved the fact that we were going to be able to someday play with them. And, in fact, we did end up going out on tour with the Beach Boys. And it was at a time, it was interesting for several reasons. The Lovin' Spoonful had just had five hits in a row, or four hits in a row, and the Beach Boys were sort of in a low period of their popularity. You know, they hadn't quite made the adjustment to letting their hair grow a little longer, and so they weren't quite as popular as they would become after Good Vibrations. But when we went out on tour, there was some difficulty, and most of the difficulty would come from Mike Love. And who's going to open the show, and who's this, and who's that? And he was so concerned with the placement of the band and who was going to be more important than the other band. And I just kind of got a little tired of his attitude. Look, he's a member of the Beach Boys, and what can you say? Everybody has difficulties with everybody else in the music business at some point or another. I just happened to take umbrage at some of the ways that he seemed to try and push his weight around within the band framework. And now in the modern era, you know, with Brian making a beautiful comeback and getting out on stage again, of course, then again last year, Mike Love once again pulls his weight and fired Brian from the Beach Boys.
Did you happen to see the Beach Boys reunion, the 50th reunion tour?
I didn't see the tour, but we worked with them last summer, and Brian wasn't with them then. You know, Brian, right, like I said, got fired from the band that he started. And we worked with them last summer out on Long Island, and it was a great show. They still do a tremendous show, no matter who's in the band. But I always love the Beach Boys, Mike Love included. They're just one of my absolute favorite bands.
Yeah.
And I just wish that Brian had not had these difficulties that he had after making his tremendous comeback from years of issues with his health.
Yeah. 1966, What's Up Tiger Lily, also the LP Hums, and then everything sort of changes in 66 when you get busted. You and Zal go to a party, you buy a bag of pot, and then you're pulled over. And you go to jail, and one of the funny things in the book is that they find a little piece of hash in your pocket, which you say is base rosin,
yeah.
Which they believe initially, which is...
That was mind-blowing. In fact, yeah. You know, I almost got it back when we were getting bailed out. They actually handed it back to me, but a narcotics detector was walking by the property window at that time and said, that's not base rosin, that's hashish. And so they put another charge on me. You know, that was... In the book, I point out, but not quite as strongly as I will right now, that I think that bust was the tipping point for the Love and Spoonful in terms of the creativity that we had been building to a climax, of course, with Summer in the City coming out just a few months after the bust. I knew that the Love and Spoonful was shooting for the stars because with the first five hits in a row, well, we knew Summer in the City was going to be, if not a number one, a top five song. So here we are placed with these five, and when you get like that in April of 1966, we had just toured in England where we played for audiences that included John Lennon and George Harrison and Stevie Winwood and Eric Clapton. The hierarchy of the London music scene came to our shows when we played in London. And so when we got off that plane in April 1966, coming back from England and Ireland, there's a phrase, oh, you feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and that's how I think the whole band felt. We felt like there was nothing that could stop us. And from the day that bust happened, you could almost feel the little air in the balloon is escaping from all of that wonderful magic that we had going for us. And it took a couple of years before it was finally all exhaled from the balloon, but that was the beginning of the end for the Love and Spoonful.
Yeah, I want to remind folks, Steve Boone is our guest today, and his book is called Hotter Than a Match, Head Life on the Run with the Love and Spoonful. And if you want the full story on the bust and all that, I recommend you pick up a copy of the book. You can get it autographed if you go to steveboone.net. Long story short, and I really don't want to get into the entire story, but you guys are arrested. The car is searched without permission, without them asking you, and you don't tell John and Joe the whole story initially, and you guys are in jail, and you are pressured basically to bring an undercover policeman to a party, and they say that will be the end of this, and no one will hear about it, the charges will be dropped, and you're conflicted because you know Zao will be deported, maybe this whole organization, all these people out of work, and reluctantly you agree to do this, and it seems like it's going to work out, and then later some of the sort of hippie culture finds out about this, and it really comes down on you. Somebody makes a pamphlet that they take the liberty to distribute to sort of say what finks you are and how terrible it is. Like you said, this is a summer of 1966 when Summer in the City goes to number one for 3 weeks, a song you co-wrote. So it's funny that at the same moment, you know, you guys are peaking, and then spiritually, like you said, the air is coming out of the balloon. Rain on the Roof, Nashville Cats, both top 10. Obviously, in retrospect, should you have... it seems like if you had just waited the police out, maybe you could have fought this in court, but it just didn't seem at the time possible to you. Is that right?
Well, it's almost right. And, you know, I don't really point the finger at anybody here to blame, but I will say this, you know, fighting the charges was never brought up as an option for us. Zali was a Canadian citizen living and working in the States on a visa, so he would have been deported at least temporarily until the charges were thrown out. The search of the car was without merit, absolutely no merit whatsoever. There's even been talk that we were set up, that the person who sold the bag of weed had informed the cops that he was going to, because we were stopped with no reason. Our papers were in order. They searched the car immediately, but we were never given the option to fight the charges. Nobody brought it up once. Our own attorney said, if you don't agree to go along with this deal with the police, Zali will be deported tomorrow morning and he'll never come back to the United States again. And so we didn't tell John and Joe on instructions from our manager and record company head to don't tell anybody. We'll keep it within the band. We'll say we're just doing some record promotion. Eventually, a week later, after everything had been done and we got down to L.A. and we hooked up again with John and Zolli, we did tell them to a certain degree that bad things have happened. And so they knew, but they should have been able to participate in the decision. And they weren't allowed to. And I've always felt that was terrible, that Zolli and I had to make this decision on our own without support of our bandmates. And we weren't getting sufficient support from our record company, and the folks that should have been in charge of our welfare and well-being weren't coming through for us, in my opinion.
Yeah. The deal you had with Karma Sutra Records, at a certain point it seemed like, when did you understand that maybe these guys weren't on the up and up and you weren't getting all the royalties you were entitled to? When did that hit you?
Well, you know, that realization came a little bit later, but what happened in 1967 when we renewed the contract, and this was after the news of the bust was just about to hit the press. It was like a year since it happened, and the word was starting to leak out, and we were presented with a new contract, and the new contract was very generous in the upfront cash they gave us, but it stated that the Love and Spoonful could consist of any group of four people, as long as John Sebastian was one of them, were what's known as the key man clause. And from that point on, even though I was anxious to sign the renewal, we never got paid any money at all. We never, ever, except for that advance, saw a single penny in royalty money from the record company, ever, until 1991, for that matter.
That is incredible.
So it was sort of a dawning awareness that something's not right here, and that me, Steve Boone, had better start taking care of business, because my name's not in the contract as a key man. And I'm sure Zolli and Joe felt the same way, but we really had, at that point, you know, I had just had the legs kicked out from underneath me with the bust, and now it's coming out in the press after the cops promised us it never would. And so it was just a very defeating feeling. And by spring of 1968, barely a year later, the band was teetering on the edge of quitting altogether. And then in June of 68, John left to go solo, and the band did suspend operations at that point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that whole period from I could say from the night of the bust until that June of 1968, it was just a very slow decline in the enthusiasm and in the spirit. And in that almost invincible feeling you get when one hit after another and all these successes and people coming up and saying, you know, Time and Newsweek kind of called us the best band of the year in 1966. So we were riding real high, and it was just a real shame that that's how it came to an end.
Yeah, you guys were on Ed Sullivan, all these different television shows. You guys were gigantic. Soundtrack to You're a Big Boy Now in 1967 with Darlin' Be Home Soon, which is one of my favorites. And then Zolli gets fired. Jerry Yester comes in the band. The whole world is changing. Music is changing. John finally leaves in 68, and there's sort of one more Love and Spoonful record. And then it's kind of over for a long time. One question, and I don't want to get into your personal finances too deeply, but when you co-write a couple of huge hits, does your BMI money, I mean, is it enough to buy a car every year? Is it enough to, you know, to take yourself out to dinner? Where on the scale is BMI money for writing two songs that have been played every day on the radio for 50 years almost?
Well, you know, today the BMI money is very nice, but this is 50 years later. In the current period of 1965-66, we didn't have any money. The Love and Spoonful members were paid a salary every day that we were on the road and working. So for 3 years, we were paid a salary, a fairly, not a great salary, but enough to pay our bills. John and I did receive some publishing royalties because of Summer in the City, and You Didn't Have to Be So Nice for Me, and they were significant. But the record royalties were non-existent. We didn't even get paid. We got an advance, and it was for the time period, it was nearly $500,000 that we split four ways.
Yeah, amazing.
Seven ways. We split it with the record company and our management and producer. But that money seemed like a lot then. Looking back now, you say, like, geez, you know, I think I got $45,000. And it doesn't, you couldn't even buy a car today for $45,000. So, but back in those days, it was a lot of money. But after that money was gone, there was never again another penny of record royalties until 1991.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. The funny thing is we've really just scratched the surface, because in some ways, the most interesting of parts of the book start after 1970, when you buy a sailboat and you sail around the Caribbean, and there's the story of your four marriages. You start a recording studio in Baltimore where Little Feat records one of their classic records. Then you move the studio to a boat where Bonnie Raitt and Robert Palmer and all these other people record, and then boats sink, and then there's You sort of start a career as a drug smuggler, sailing back and forth, including one story where you get paid with 135 pounds of pot. I think the biggest load you took around was something like 5,000 or 8,000 pounds of drugs. It's absolutely amazing. And then you're on drugs. And again, this is where the honesty of the book, it really comes in. You just lay it out there. You have a real hard time getting out of the drug life. Eventually, you do it. And the band sort of gets back together, and you sort of get your life back together. You do volunteer work, and you're doing music and stuff. And then finally, in 91, the Love and Spoonful, you and Joe reform a new version of the Love and Spoonful with Jerry, and you've been playing pretty consistently, 20 or 30 or 40 gigs a year since then, all around. And it seems like you've kind of, one of the things that's amazing to me with all of this is that your memory is so good. That's kind of lucky, don't you think?
Well, it's almost like it was ironed into my brain or seared into my brain, because it was so dramatic. All these things that happened to me that are sort of like things you can't forget unless you're just insensitive. And I do have a good memory. I'm not great on remembering what I'm going to the store for today, but I can tell you right now details of things during that period from 1965 until 1991, when really all of this stuff was happening within my personal life. And then, of course, after 1991, the band did reform, and with Jerry Yester and two sidemen that we just love, Mike Arturi and Philip Smith, filling out the band. It's great fun. We go out there, we play just the Spoonful songs, and we do a medley of songs that were friends of ours did back. Of course, Jerry's brother Jim Yester was in the association. So, and in fact, Jim, for the first year we were back together with us, Jim Yester was in the Love and Spoonful for a year, and then he decided he wanted to go out and pursue a solo career on his own. But it's been a great run since 1991, and now we're looking to starting our 50th year in June, and we're expecting to have a nice string of concerts to do. So it's been great, man. I have absolutely no complaints. Yes, I've had some experiences that most people wouldn't want to have in their life, but, I managed to survive them. And I feel real good about life right now. I'm in a very happy marriage and live in a wonderful little town, very modest lifestyle. I don't live extravagantly. I couldn't afford to, but that's okay. I'm real good with where I'm at right now.
Steve Boone is our guest, and the book is called Hotter Than a Matchhead, Life on the Run with the Love and Spoonful. You can pick up your copy at steveboone.net or check out theloveandspoonful.com and see where the band will be playing, hopefully this summer. 50 years is an incredible time. And it really kind of, it amazes me that, you started off with this military father and this kind of all-American 50s childhood, and then you go through all this stuff, all the hippie stuff, all the drug stuff, all the being ripped off stuff. I mean, it's the story we've sort of heard it different ways a million times, and then finally you sort of are happy. It's taken a long time, though, to finally get this happiness together.
I'm just going to throw this in there because you sort of set the stage for it. My dad was, very upstart. He was a real deal, man. He joined the Marine Corps when he was too old to go into the service, and he used political connections to get in during World War II. But you know something? He also grew up on eastern Long Island in the 1920s during Prohibition. And although I don't have any direct knowledge of this, I would be very surprised if he didn't have something to do with offloading cases of rum and other spirits that are being imported by the bootleggers during that era. That was in Long Island, and especially out in the Hamptons, was an area that was ripe for that kind of...
So maybe the smuggling is in your blood, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it might be in the blood.
I've got You Didn't Have to Be So Nice queued up here, a song that... that you are the co-writer of, a song that went, I think, to number 10 in 1965. It's just a beautiful song, a great recording, a great arrangement. Just tell me a little story about it.
Well, you know, it's the first song I wrote that actually had a success of any kind. And I had been hyped about this girl that was a friend of John and Zolly's, a Canadian gal who was going to come down from Toronto to New York to visit and meet the band, and Zolly in particular was going, this gal is perfect gal for you. Her name is Nurit Wilde. And when we did finally meet, she was a terrific, and still is. I keep in touch with her. But it was one of those situations where too much pressure had been put on us to become a couple right away. And you know, it takes time for a relationship to develop. So the idea for the song came from meeting Nurit. And it wasn't like, well, we didn't hit it off or anything, but we just didn't become a couple. And so in my head, I heard this. I've been playing a piano piece. Every time I get near a piano, it had no lyrics. And one day the lyric, "You didn't have to be so nice, I would have liked you anyway," came to me. And then I started that out, got the first part of a verse written, and then John heard the melody and said, "What do you got there?" And I played what I had, and we sat down, and it was the first song we worked together on, and it came out terrific. I'm very proud of that song.
Yeah, I love this one. Let's hear it now. Steve Boone, thanks for visiting with us and joining with us, and like I said, thanks for your honesty. I don't know, maybe it's freeing in some ways, but it's not always easy to put your cards on the table, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak on the air with you, too. So, Mike, anytime you want to talk at all, it was a great interview. I enjoyed it a bunch and look forward to hearing from you again.
I will be in touch. Thank you so much, Steve.
Bye-bye.
I'm not afraid to You're doing it right. Just put your head back.
There's Kim Fowley, The Trip, a song which he claims he just made up right there, which I guess he must have. I think you get a taste from that excerpt of the interview. What an interesting guy he was. What a complicated guy he was. He clearly had a lot invested in being cool, but he also was cool. Just very, very, very interesting. When I contacted him, he started calling me at home, and he called me at home a few times, and he would talk for an hour. My wife and I were just discussing this, and we would say, I remember I would come upstairs from my office in the basement and say to my wife, you know, I would sort of have a shell-shocked look on my face because he was so overwhelming. He would just talk to you for an hour on the phone. Anyway, my friend Francis McDonald is the drummer of Teenage Fan Club. He is a composer, a writer. He was the drummer and songwriter of the BMX Bandits for years. He's played in lots of bands, owned a record label in Glasgow, manages Camera Obscura, does a million things. But Kim Fowley produced a country band that Frank was in, I believe, and also produced a BMX Bandits record and co-wrote some songs with him. And Frank had some dealings with him, and I think he stayed in Frank's house. So I thought we'd hear right from somebody who worked with Kim what it was like working with him, and I'm happy to welcome Francis to the show. Good morning, Francis. How are you?
Hello, Michael. I'm good. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you pretty well. I think you were on my show when it was a Saturday night show back in 1997 or something. Do you remember that? Years ago.
I do remember, yeah, I remember. And I was doing my American accent, my impersonation of an American priest. Oh my God, because you are so good. That's the one line I can do in an American accent. So anyway, but moving on.
So how did you get in touch with Kim Fowley? How did you get him to Glasgow to produce records? How did it happen?
There's a kind of dreamer in Glasgow called Jason McPhail, and Jason is a record collector, and Jason would make things happen. Like, he asked Dan Penn to come to Glasgow, and Dan Penn, because no one asked him to do gigs, said okay, and then Jason said, we'll get the BMX Bandits to be a backing band. So we learned Do Right Women and Dark End of the Street. You know, a kind of collaboration that would never happen if it hadn't been Jason that came up with it. And he had a similar idea with Kim Fowley. He wanted to bring Kim Fowley to Glasgow and BMX Bandits would be his backing band. This was about 1995 or 6. So I then had to deal with Kim on the phone before he came over, working out how we backed him up. And then I said, maybe when you're in town, you'd record a couple of songs for a single for Shoeshine, my label. And then Kim, you know, you give him an inch, he'd take a mile. He then wanted to produce and co-write the next BMX Bandits album, Recreation, and then he came and stayed at my house for 3 nights with me and my mother. you get 1 hour on the phone with him. I had him in the house for 3 nights with my mother. So, and just gradually, one project led to another. And I suppose I did different stuff with him over a period of years. That was the start. We were asked to back him up for a gig, and then it just led to more things.
You know, I don't know if you heard that. I just played a little interview excerpt there, and He's such a strong personality, and you know, one of the things that had me thinking was how much of it is the real him. Was there a real him? Was there another layer below that, the kind of, because he had a sense of humor about his own wordiness and about his own opinions and things like that. But it was hard to tell what was where it all started and where it ended. Did you feel you got below that or not?
I felt like Kim kind of respected me a little bit, and I kind of liked him. And he could be obnoxious to a lot of different people, and I wouldn't kind of excuse that. But I just know that I kind of rolled with the punches, and we kind of got on okay. So I think I knew him a little more, because if you just met him, you know, if he walked into a rehearsal room and you were going to learn songs with him, he'd be psyching you out and saying obnoxious things and outrageous and pushing you and testing his limits, and then he didn't always do that with me. After a while, we could talk about other things and I could ask him advice about the music industry or different anecdotes. But I think he was very intelligent and very restless, and he had a high sex drive as well, and so he would wear people out very easily. the first time I spoke to him, I had to, we were going to back him up, and I didn't realise you were saying earlier on about the trip, how he made that up on the spot. That I absolutely believe that, because Kim would always try and make songs up spontaneously, kind of show off. He never wanted to repeat himself. So I was on the phone, but hi, Kim, it's going to be great to play with you in Glasgow, and could we do some of your songs here, like International Heroes and Bubblegum? He's like, how old are you, Francis? I'm 27. I wrote that when I was 26, 30 years ago at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not going to sing it now. So, okay. So he would control the conversation, and then at the rehearsal, he would say, okay, play Gloria by them. And he'd start playing the riff, and he'd make up a song over it, and he did that 20 times, and that was our set list. So, you know, and then the gig was kind of legendary. It was amazing to see him in action and working, conjuring this craziness out of nothing. It was a really, really exciting. I mean, I do think he was kind of a genius. He was kind of a musical prostitute in some ways. He'd do anything. He didn't have great quality control, and he would wear people out. He wanted to come back to Glasgow and be a house producer in a studio like it was the 60s and bring projects in. And we were saying, well, there's not enough going on. You'll get bored and everyone will fall out with you, you know. But so when I heard he died, Michael, it'd been a while since I spoke to him, and I wanted to write a blog about him, and I couldn't think of what to write, because all I could think was boiling it down to, it was, I didn't know anyone like him, because even trying to come up with an anecdote, you miss out so many other things, you know, or an impersonation or a memory. It was overwhelming.
One of the things, it seems like he is, that he was, you know, I don't know, genius, but there was he was different. He was wired differently. I'm a strong believer that what you do is who you are. It's not really what you say about yourself. And if you look at what this guy did every day, all day for, you know, years and years and years, it really is very, very unusual. You know, I mean, and I wish I had a better finger on where all that came from. I'm not sure. I mean, go ahead.
Well, I think he had a damaged childhood. And I think that cast a shadow for a long time. He would say, like, his father was an actor, Douglas Fowley, I guess he was in, he had a part in Singing in the Rain, among other things, as one of the directors. It's kind of getting really frustrating, George Purse cutting about the megaphone. And Kim told me that his dad used to make Kim learn his lines, or help him learn his lines, and if Kim got something wrong, he'd hit him in the face. You know, I'm sure that was just the thin end of the wedge. I think he had a pretty difficult, damaged childhood, so he was very intelligent but unloved, and I think because as well he was quite needy. You know, he'd phone you up and talk for an hour, he'd be on the phone to someone else for the next hour, someone else for the next hour, and you know, I remember him in Glasgow going to see him. He was the BBC put him up because they were doing a radio session or something. I didn't have him back in my house a second time, and I went around to see him, and I couldn't get out of the room. He just kept talking and wanted to tell me, and his anecdotes were brilliant. They were totally entertaining. All the, you know, early in the 60s and debauched, all the people he met, you know, and you know, he'd say a name, mention a name. I'd say, okay, the Beatles. He said, I asked John Lennon, John, what was the secret of the Beatles? And he said, we took our favourite records and made them better. Great answer, John. So, ask me another one. I'd say, Lou Reed, oh, he's scared of me. Ask me another one, you know, Brian Wilson. And he would just, you know, he would enjoy all that, but he couldn't. You know, it's like he couldn't be alone with his thoughts. He maybe had difficulty with kind of intimate personal relationships, so he was just charging about, putting all his energy into things just to not be bored.
You told me this story once of when he was staying at your house with your mum, where I stayed once, and she was a sweet, sweet lady and put up with all sorts of rock and roll people coming through there with not batting an eyelid. And I think she was very proud that I think Kim took her food to the recording studio because he didn't trust the recording or the silverware or something. You told me this story that the BMX Bandits have the song on the theme park album called Nuclear Summertime, and while Kim was eating breakfast, he sort of just rewrote the words in the most casually brilliant way.
Yes, I had a song called Teenage Summertime, which was a bit one-dimensional, and he's sitting there eating, you know, my mum's kind of whatever it was, microwave peas with butter or something in there. And of course, he was very good at being charming to my mother, and as soon as she left the room, you know, this is lovely soup, Mrs. McDonald. Oh, thanks, Kim. And she'd walk out and he'd start, another thing about the being expensive, you can't play, don't give me respect, blah, blah. So I think one of the reasons we got on right enough was because he would say, let's write a song, and people would be thinking, what, now, here? And I'd grab the guitar and start playing chords and try and do it with him, so we clicked a little bit that way. But I'd written this song, Teenage Summertime, and then sang it to him, and what do you think? It's horrible, you know. You could call it nuclear. And I said, that's going to scam? He said, yeah. And then all of a sudden, all words about, you know, wearing shades when the sun goes down took on a whole new significance, because it was a nuclear summertime, not a teenage summertime. And I had these lines from mid late, and he's sitting eating his breakfast, and I'm reading them out, and he's going, horrible, you know. And I would say a line, and he would rewrite it, and I'd say another line, and he would rewrite it, and transforming it. But you're right, while, you know, looking completely bored and trying to go on with the breakfast, and recorded it, and, you know, it was very, very exciting. And that's something as well, that Kim was a catalyst. He could bully a song out of note. He couldn't play chords. He had a sense of melody. He could sing something over something that you played, but he couldn't write a song on his own. He needed someone. But he could just, it could be 3 a.m, you're all tired, and he would just make you play it and then come up with something that wouldn't have existed otherwise. And that, I think that was part of
what
made him an interesting producer at that time. He was a catalyzer and an energizer.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. You guys made a record together called Fantasy World. It's really, I think, it's sort of a collaboration, but it's a Kim Fowley record, and I think it's you playing all the instruments and Kim writing the lyrics and doing the singing, and again, the songs were written almost instantly. Isn't that right?
Well, with that one, there was a collaboration, or a combination, because I said, Kim, when you come to Glasgow and we do this record, I'd like you to have some lyrics that, you know, like, you know, we have a chorus that repeats, you know, things like that, a bit more of a pop, because his own songs, like The Trip, are often monologues over me. So I said, you know, songs like Bubblegum, and he said, Bubblegum the song or Bubblegum the style? And I said, well, both, you know, hips and riffs. So he did find some lyrics, and he'd say, I wrote for The Birds in 1969, they didn't use it, or this was a runaway thing, they didn't use it. But then, for example, there's a song called Schoolgirl X and on that album, and I just started playing chords, and he made up the lyrics, and if you ever listen to that and hear it from start to finish, and you realise the vocal was done in one take, and what he does with the narrative, it's kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
So he, you know, sometimes you could tame him and focus him a little bit, and other times he would just say, roll the tape, watch what I can do, and start showing off.
Francis McDonald, this has been truly illuminating. It really is a great way to sort of get a little closer to Kim Fowley and to just to remember him that way. I've got Schoolgirl X queued up here from the Fantasy World record. It's a fantastic song, and it's pure Kim Fowley. The music is great, and the music, your part of it is great. It's just a great number one hit pop song. But yeah, it's a perfect vehicle for just Kim to kind of his warped view on reality and pop music.
Well,
yeah.
All the lyrics were done in one go, if anyone's listening. And Michael, it's really great to talk to you, and thanks for thinking of giving me a call.
I appreciate it. Thanks for visiting me. I'll talk to you soon, Frank. Thanks.
Okay, take care.
Sunday school. I am an older boy living in a world so cruel. You're my schoolgirl. You are my schoolgirl ex. You are the mystery lady, and I'm the boy who you say is really next. Diamonds from the sky of teenage blues. You and I have a summertime where we don't have a thing to lose. Schoolgirl X, you're my schoolgirl. I'm the boy that you say is going to be next.
cookies and ice cream. We sit at the shadows and dream of what life's going to be when we both turn 21. That was 100 years ago. We're chained to the past, and our hair is as white as snow. But when you kiss me on the lips, we go back into the past. You're still my schoolgirl, and my schoolboy love will last. Schoolgirl, schoolgirl X, I'm the boy that you said was next. You kept your promise for 100 years, and I'm going to climb and scream all the time. Schoolgirl X, you kept your promise of the boy was next. Well, now we're both about to die. We're going to go away to the teenage heaven up in a teenage sky. We're going to have a teenage eternity, just you and I. We'll always be forever be young and in love. We'll listen to the music of the soda shop and the hot rod and the surf. There'll be no drum machines, there'll be no diseases. There's just gonna be you and I and the flowers and the trees in the schoolyard. Rockin' tonight at the school dance, and we'll be all right and all our friends till the happy end. There's no use pretending, but it's true, cause you are my school. Next, you kept your promise. I love you, Schoolgirl X.